Sunu Chandy. The series is produced by Forest Woods Media Productions. Post-production by Mike Turpin, MET Studios. We wish to thank the Library of Congress for making the program possible. Funding is provided by the Sinipet Fund, Natalie Canavor, and Sandy Jackson Cohen. Our engineer is Mike Turpin, and I'm Grace Cavalieri.
Hi, this is Pat Metheny. You're listening to Radio KBOO here.
You're listening to Art Focus on KBOO Portland, the show where artists talk about their work. I want to remind you that KBOO is a volunteer-powered community platform. That means we are funded by you, the listener. If you're enjoying this program, please show your support by making a contribution today, or better yet, become a monthly sustaining member. Just go to kboo.fm/give or text the letters KBOO to the number 44321. Thanks very much.
Andy whoa, whoa, looks a scream. Had him on my whoa, whoa, whoa. Andy whoa, whoa, silver screen. Can't tell them apart at all.
My name's Joseph Gallivan. You're listening to Art Focus on KBOO Portland. My guest this week is Bruce Gunter. He's the adjunct curator for special exhibitions at the Oregon Jewish Museum and Center for Holocaust Education. Thanks for doing Art Focus again, Bruce.
Always a pleasure, Joseph. You have a great audience.
Here, there are two new art shows at the newly reopened Oregon Jewish Museum. One is Salvador Dali work, and the other one contrasts and compares Henk Pender from the 20th century with Rembrandt from the 17th century. So first we'll talk about Dali.
The Dali is a specific group, a commissioned work that was made for the 20th anniversary of the founding of Israel. And in this work, he talks about the dream in which he takes a narrative about the course of coming to Israel, of finding the land, of making the land, and emerging as a nation, or as a homeland, if you will, for the Jewish people. And so it comes at a time in Dali's life when he is perhaps at his pinnacle of international reputation as an artist. He had yet to become completely metamorphosed as a personality and an early advocate of celebrity as a cloak for creative activity.
So he became kind of a self-parody in the 70s.
Yes, but in this work, he is specifically commissioned to reflect on a series of real events and the conflict that brought the partition and the birth of Israel as a nation following World War II. The works are an interesting blend of his typical iconography that comes out of the surreal, dreamlike landscapes and the figures as they move as surrogates and anonymous beings through the landscape with the actual events and situations of Israel. And so in these works, you see his vocabulary meeting the commission and the idea of how he envisions this. In a work like The Land at the Start of the Jewish Settlement, it's really about somehow the beginnings. And it is a desert-like plain that stretches back as a watercolor, or these are lithographs made from the large-scale paintings that were commissioned. And in them, he reinvents parts of the painting as prints. And so these lithographs have a water-like sand landscape across which a diagonal of a large water pipe, you know, the water that will come to the desert to make the desert bloom once more. And around it are vignetted, quickly sketched, invented figures, a figure on a horse, figures in conversation, exploring, almost a La Mancha kind of figure here, a figure with a staff leading a child. And above it, an angel-like form floating over the sky, a couple meeting, incidents and accidents of the ink with which he drew the initial figures.
Lots of splashes, right?
Yes, splashes. And it's the freedom he was using in his studio work that then animate these prints. And I think it's what's interesting as you survey the room from one corner is you're aware of how color is the dynamic that leads you in, that stops the eye, that changes the direction as you survey the print itself. And that's a device he was using in his paintings at this time, but also it's a great device to allow him to shift time frames and place and emotional tenor in a work. You know, and so it's in this work, it's about the change, the beginnings, how the beginning required water, it began a time. Another one, the land come to life, you know, the mountains and the hills break forth with, and it's about the way that the agriculture and the land began to come back from its dryness and the water. And so all of these prints are about the kind of history of that 20-year saga of the partition and then the founding of the nation. And they exist in a very interesting way. He blends them, I think, with a rather gentle hand, his normal surrealist and sexualized imagery takes a secondary role, a background role that still animates some of the figures in a work like The Land of Milk and Honey and lyrical ones of music and the creativity in Israel and come forward. He doesn't lose his voice in the commission, but he asserts this place that is post-surreal. It's beyond the dream state and the unconscious, and it becomes then grounded in fact, moment, history, as he opens the door to the creative act and to how this series of 20 works really crosses the lines and brings to life the saga and the conflict that raised this and the motivation in the Second World War and the Holocaust and the founding of the state to make the homeless homeless no more. One of the things that I think is quite beautiful in this exhibition is there are, because it is the Oregon Jewish Museum and the Center for Holocaust, we've looked at the archives that the museum holds that are document Jewish lives and participation in Oregon, and found a series of travel documents, security ID cards, photographs of people who traveled, who lived in Oregon, but who had traveled after the war, perhaps first to Palestine and then into Israel and then came to the United States and ended up in Oregon. And so these are the narratives mm-hmm. that come from, like Joshua Stamford, the great rabbi, our generation in Portland, their narrative, letters, diaries, photographs, all of these artifacts of real lives inside this room filled with dreamlike reflections on a 20-year history. As an exhibition, it combines the two things that I think the museum's program hopes to do. It brings world-class voices to talk about Jewish identity and Jewish life in the modern world. It opens the door for non-Jewish audiences to experience and hear those voices and to establish the shared humanity of our late 20th, early 21st century lives.
Dali was not Jewish. He was commissioned, right? And he would do this if he was well paid.
Yes, because one of the great things about Salvador Dali is he was a commercial success, and that what led to his critical downfall as an artist, because he was willing to pursue things, and it's in the period of the 70s when he falls into the hands of a couple of people who were exploiting his insecurities in a great way. So
the other two artists you organize this part of the exhibition, Rembrandt and Hank Panda. So in the Rembrandt section, which is all on these claret walls, a kind of internal feel to the museum, these are etchings by Rembrandt, and he went to live in a Jewish section of Amsterdam, which was a place of religious freedom. It attracted Jews from Southern Europe, and Rembrandt was doing these etchings of Jewish people, some on biblical subjects, and using different models.
We decided that we would look at the Jewish community of Amsterdam, which has been there for over 400 years, and how these two master artists in their time reflected, observed, recorded, and interacted with the Jewish community. Rembrandt, who moves to Amsterdam as he is becoming a very successful and popular portrait, wants to establish his sense of place in the community, and he buys a new home in a new section of Amsterdam, which during the 22 years he lived in that house, Amsterdam quadrupled in size, and they built three major new canals, which quadrupled the physical size of the city. It was because of the economic prosperity and engine that the Dutch East India Company was that afforded the artists of the Dutch Golden Age, in which the collecting of art, the enhancement of bourgeois life and the merchant class made the life of Rembrandt and hundreds of artists possible. He is active at a moment when he is able to receive commissions and interact with the Jewish community. He moves to a Sephardic neighborhood of Portuguese and Spanish Jews who came to Amsterdam because of the Inquisition, and then later in the 1590, when Spain overran and took control of Portugal. A whole group of Jews who had moved there initially left and brought their wealth and their business connections to Amsterdam. They become part of the international global East India Company. It was a joint held stock. So they become his commissioner, and they commission him, and he begins to work with and the patronage. Like Ephraim Bonus, Ephraim Bueno, a Portuguese Sephardic Jew who was a doctor, who became a very prominent doctor, is a good example of the place that Amsterdam was for Jews to live. The Union of Utrecht had given them the freedom to pursue their own religious life, and it empowered them to live in an economic and social integrated state. Unlike Venice, where Jews were constricted to the ghetto and on one island in the larger Veneto, here they could live wherever they chose. They interacted with the community. The rabbis met with the Calvinist Protestants who were in the process of translating the Bible and needed the help of the rabbis to help translate the Hebrew Bible. So it's a very fluid moment. So for a rabbi, Menachem ben Israel, he's commissioned to illustrate his treatise on the Pedra Gloriosa,
the Rock of Daniel.
Yes, the Rock of Daniel. And so he makes a series of prints on vellum that are published in the book. The publishing industry, which flourishes in Amsterdam in the 17th century, is also an industry that comes to be dominated by Jewish printers, which is an interesting thought to keep in mind when we look at Hank Pander. But so Rembrandt is pulled into that industry as an artist who could provide certain kinds of subjects. It is in those etchings that we see here, we see reflected the Jewish life in Amsterdam.
These are dry point etchings?
Yes, they're dry point. Well, there's also a dry point aquatint. He really expands his vocabulary of printmaking in Amsterdam. And during this period, this almost 30-year period that the exhibition covers, he is there working with a printer and with his own printing press to grow his vocabulary. So, but most of these are dry point etchings, the direct assault of the print, and they have a delicacy in these lifetime prints that changes as they become.
Are these actual size as he worked on them?
Yes.
They're not shrunk down.
No.
Okay. So you have Rembrandt with this very fine tool. You know, these are black and white, mostly lines, sort of cross-hatching, bit of shadow, and he's doing faces that look human. These are like gnarled fields, you know, people from the street kind of faces. And the other thing is you get to see the Rembrandt kind of use of light, a bright lit focus and a gloomy kind of edges.
Well, yeah, because I think that this is the period when his study with Peter Lastman, one of the Caravaggiste Dutch painters, who was his mentor, he takes that whole notion of the shadow and the light, the line and the cross-hatching, and he balances those things so that the compositions are very dynamic. On our labels, I note when they are first state, third state of a print, because what would happen is Rembrandt would start a plate and he would draw it, he would make a series of prints, and then he would come back to it, and he would, the composition would evolve and the complexity would evolve. And a good example, I think, is in this Abraham's Sacrifice, in which Rembrandt has the center of the print opens up, and the highlight is of Isaac at the altar and Abraham about to sacrifice his only son to God, and an angel comes and stills his hand and stops him. And so what happens is this the second state, Rembrandt has the wings which are imagined or in the memory, they're in chiaroscuro, they're dark, they're cross-hatched back, and it is the two faces, Abraham looking into the eyes of the angel who has stilled his hands as his son kneels, Abraham covering his son's eyes. You know, so there's the drama is right here in the dead center of the print in bright light. In later states, the chiaroscuro moves in.
And so the edges get darker?
Yeah, the surrounding ground becomes darker. The pathway between the ritual altar, the kneeling son, the hand, and the interchange stays up, but the cloak goes back. And so the physical dimensional representation changes. You know, and that's the brilliance of what Rembrandt's about as an artist. He takes a two-dimensional plane and he begins to carve space, and he creates the drama, and both drama and emotional verisimilitude. His portraits are world famous because of that.
His oil
paintings are the same way. You know, where they come in, the darkness pools and puddles around the figure, and then the figure's face emerges and it reveals. Mm-hmm. And it's something you said earlier about the humanity of the faces and the immediacy of them. And that's an essential part of, I think, Rembrandt's gift to history. He changed the representation of Jews in art because he lived in that community for 22 years. He drew them, he interacted with them, and he gave them, for the first time in Western art, a sense of humanity. Before, they had been caricatured as Shylock, as evil in the kind of Catholic Christian iconography. And for Rembrandt, they were his neighbors, they were his patrons, they were his friends. And he gives them the animation that he gives all of his portraits, recognizing that which we share emotionally, the longings and the satisfactions of life as they're reflected in our faces. And he records the humanity of his neighbors and of the people. And that's one of the gifts of the show. It's interesting to see. In my installation, you mentioned the claret walls. I wanted to create a sense of the two time frames in the history of the Amsterdam Jews. You know, there, it's a 400-year history, but here we're with Rembrandt, we're seeing the pinnacle of wealth, of the immigration of Jews from around Europe to the freedom of Amsterdam, the freedom of association, of religion, to live their lives as people in a community. And so it's the core of the exhibit is in within these claret walls. When you step out, you step across hundreds of years to another critical moment in the history of Amsterdam, which Hank Pander, another non-Jewish artist.
Mm-hmm. Portland art.
So Hank died this year, but he made these paintings. He was born in 1937 in Harlem.
Harlem.
The Netherlands. Double A. And so he grew up. He was 8 years old when the war ended. He had intense personal experience and memories of the Nazi occupation, the destruction of the Harlem Temple, his father as an illustrator and an artist who had worked for Jewish publishers in Harlem. He witnessed them disappearing as they were forced to move to Amsterdam, and then they were taken to the death camps. He had those visible memories. Then as a young man who survived the war, although nearly starved to death during it, he went to art school in Amsterdam, and there he walked the streets, and he talked about this. He walked the empty streets of the Jewish neighborhoods.
So this was 5 years after the war?
5 years after the war.
Still and empty.
People still empty, because 75% of the Jews of the Netherlands were murdered in the camps. And of those who came back, less than 20% came back to Amsterdam. They either went to Palestine and Israel, or they went to the United States. They settled elsewhere. They discovered their life was empty, that it was destroyed here. What he did in walking these neighborhoods, these are the neighborhoods that, and the streets that Rembrandt had literally walked. In one of the paintings, the Rembrandthof, it's here.
Mm-hmm. Rembrandt's and, sort of brown townhouse.
Yes, it was
four-story
house that he, the grand house he bought as a successful portraitist and one of the leading artists of Amsterdam, surrounded by Jewish neighborhoods. And so this is a street that Rembrandt lived on, mm-hmm, in that neighborhood. So what he did is he went back and re-imaged. In other words, he took his memory and that kind of phenomenological physical experience that memory can be of walking those streets as a 20-year-old.
In the 50s.
In the 50s, 1950, when he was an art student, and the empty houses, the buildings that had never, no one came back from the camps, and they were still empty. They became squats in the late 50s, you know, because buildings were still emptied because of the war. Their ownership clouded by, are they alive? Are they gone? And they were clearly gone. So he re-images them. He takes photographs in 2018.
2018.
Yes.
He goes back again.
Because his family is there, he's one of 11 children. And so he goes back and he photographs those streets, because he's been making, since the mid-90s, Hank started making paintings because he thought of himself as a history painter. He began making paintings about his wartime experiences in Harlem and a narrative about the Dutch experience, sui generis. And then he then goes back to specifically make these paintings to the memories of Amsterdam, and their memories that reinvent, re-image the streets at the end of the war.
Mm-hmm.
So the immediacy of the end of the war is there. An abandoned bicycle, a broken window. It's as if the buildings are bleeding.
Yeah, what are these streaks coming down
well,
the building?
Are they broken water pipes? Is it the rain? Or as it psychologically and emotionally, is it the sorrows that come pouring out of the windows of these stripped apartments? Because when the Nazis shipped the Jews to the death camps, they stripped their apartments of anything that was usable to ship to Germany,
mm-hmm,
because, you know, to as they did all over Europe with Jewish belongings, to give the working class and the widows of the war in Germany chairs, china, whatever they,
mm-hmm,
needed.
Mm-hmm. So these are big oil paintings, maybe like 6x5.
Correct.
Henk Panda went back, took photos of the streets as they were in 2018. So there's like Starbucks and,
right,
you know, normal shops. But he just wanted the shape of the buildings.
Right. So he wanted to know what the cornice looked like.
Yeah.
He wanted to know the rhythm of the windows. As his memory had such a strong emotional content, he could take the photographs. Because these are the buildings that were there. And they're a mix of 17th, 18th, and 19th century buildings. As you look at them, the very earliest picture is of the Kapellenstraat. And those are easily 17th century, mm-hmm, or if maybe even 16th century buildings.
So he's done, it's a cobbled street with an old tire abandoned, broken windows, a crooked tree.
Right.
Just not much in the street, like broken rubble and
glass. Rubble, you know, it's the rubble, of a collapsing roof, of the haste at which people left, of the liberation of Amsterdam, you know, with the Nazis evacuating. But it is a street that echoes the very beginning of the moment when Amsterdam expands. And the new neighborhoods that Rembrandt's house is in, and the big houses that the Sephardic merchants were building, were established. What's beautiful about these paintings is your impression is of this glorious skies, these skies that are erupting in rainbows and clouds and blue sky. It's really a mix of them.
Mm-hmm.
All of them agitated skies. You know, they're skies of transition. They're skies of that impart the bright light on the buildings and the deep shadows. They're that kind of interaction of light in the northern climate that's so essential to understanding. I think I was so happy to be able to bring these together, because Henk's paintings in reimagining these streets tells a story about the 20th century and actually the end of the because the Jewish community in Amsterdam never reached the heights and the size that it has not regained that. They've not become, it's remained a minority community now in Amsterdam. World War II, which unified the resistance to fascism and gave us a horrific history and a memory of what is possible in the human nature to do to another human being. That reality which we've come to live with and now see repeated again and again in the modern era, in the contemporary days, is sobering. And so I think by presenting these on stark white walls in a very contemporary 20th century way, as opposed to the claret walls of history, you know, it was a device in order to allow the two voices of these master artists their own space.
Mm-hmm.
And the beauty of the paintings is in their creation. The image is sobering and nuanced. It's about the loss and the resilience somehow of this place to continue.
My name is Joseph Gallivan. You've been listening to Art Focus on KBOO Portland. My guest this week was Bruce Gunter. He's the adjunct curator for special exhibitions at the Oregon Jewish Museum and Center for Holocaust Education. He was talking about the two new shows at the reopened museum. One is about Salvador Dali and the foundation of Israel, and the other is a compare and contrast of Rembrandt's work in Amsterdam in the Jewish quarter and Henk Panda's revisiting of the same streets 300 or 400 years later. Thanks very much for doing Art Focus again, Bruce.
My pleasure, Joseph. Thank you very much for inviting us.
You're listening to Art Focus on KBOO Portland, the show where artists talk about their work. I want to remind you that KBOO is a volunteer-powered community platform. That means we are funded by you, the listener. If you're enjoying this program, please show your support by making a contribution today or become a monthly sustaining member. Just go to kboo.fm/give or text the letters KBOO to the number 44321. Thanks very much.
Andy, whoa, whoa, looks a scream, hang him on my wall. Andy, whoa, whoa, silver screen, can't tell them apart at all.
Estás escuchando a KBOO Portland en el 90.7 FM, K2H2BH Philomath en el 104.3 FM y K220HR Hood River en el 91.9 FM.
Bienvenidos a un breve informativo en su estación comunitaria KBOO 90.7 FM. Hoy martes 13 de junio del 2023. Ucrania dice que recuperó 4 aldeas en la región oriental de Donetsk después de que el presidente Vladimir Zelensky confirmara el sábado que había comenzado la tan esperada contraofensiva de Ucrania. En Colombia, 4 niños indígenas fueron encontrados vivos en la Amazonía 40 días después de que su avión se estrelló.